Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We the people own this bank. We the people either flourish or don't flourish. And so it is truly the we the people system. I can't explain it more simply, because in our heads we're playing the same old storyline, which is, well, in the conventional commercial banking world, if there's a run on the bank closes because there's not enough money on deposit to pay the depositors. You and I know that there's actually no assets supporting that loan except our ability to pay from our labor. And what I'm saying is, if you structure a proper public bank founded on the verified assets of the jurisdiction, then you have a far more robust, properly constituted banking system that's backed by assets.
That's our featured guest this week, author and economist Mark Anielski, describing the largest but little-known public bank in North America, the Alberta Treasury Branches, or ATB, in Alberta, Canada. Today, we're going to dive into how yet another public bank institution managed to transform its home economy, survive the onslaught of the private banking powers, and now stand on the verge of a new generation of financial capabilities. If you're interested in public banking, Mark has an interesting bit of reporting to share that will be news to most of you. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. You may have noticed recently that there's a lot of talk in the form of op-eds, new books, press articles, and studies from major institutions about the need for publicly owned financial institutions to address the chronic issues within the banking world and government finance. This call has a global resonance. Everyone seems to realize that the public interest and assets are not being served sufficiently, and worse, are at the heart of deteriorating democracies and economies worldwide. Especially now, with the 10th anniversary of the 2008 financial collapse, we're seeing retrospectives on what happened and why, and what is likely to happen the next time these folks break their banks. Will they get bailed out again? Will the government have the courage to let them go bust and nationalize them? Will public banks fill the gap? Might the Fed itself be nationalized? Some of these questions are likely to get answered just in the course of trying to keep things floating. Debt weighs down our ship of state, our commonwealth, and our cities and states have yet to embrace truly creative alternatives to taking on more. But some are trying, as you may know, and their efforts are being buoyed and driven by citizens that are demanding serious changes. Will these democratic uprisings have the ability to stand up to the financial powers that be? Later on in this program, we'll take a look behind the curtain of the global financial cartel as Bob Bowes lays out for us how the financial powers control things around the world and what their macro plans are for our futures. And Ellen has a new article out this week that in itself raises the eyebrows of the concerned. Called Central Banks Are Buying Up the Planet. You get the drift of where today's program leads.
So you've called the article Central Banks Are Buying Up the Planet, yet another aspect of the global financial cartel and how it operates. How is it that these banks are so centrally involved in the global markets?
Well, our Federal Reserve is actually not allowed to buy stocks, but other central banks don't have the same rules. And there is, as Nomi Prince points out in her book, Collusion, they are colluding. So there is reason to suspect that our Fed is putting them up to it. But it used to be that central banks would buy stocks in a very limited way, like maybe to prop up a particular failing company. such as actually the Federal Reserve in effect bought General Motors and AIG in 2008, 2009, actually lending the money, but they bought the stock, I guess, for at least for a time. But that was because these companies were failing and it was thought they were critical and it was thought necessary to bail them out. And then after the Dodd-Frank Act changed it so the Fed couldn't lend to individual companies. They could only lend to a sector. Like if you're going to lend to General Motors, you're going to have to lend to all the car companies or something like that. But other central banks, and particularly the Swiss National Bank and the Bank of Japan, the most aggressive players, are actively buying in their stock markets. And the Swiss National Bank is acting like a hedge fund. It's buying up the big stocks, the big tech stocks, like Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft. So these are the stocks that everybody buys. All the big investors buy. And so when they see the central banks buying them, jumping on it, then they all jump in. So that makes the big stocks go up, which makes the market go up. But the smaller stocks apparently are actually in negative territory for the year. But there's reason to suspect that it's the Fed that's putting them up to it in order to make it look like their tactics have been working when they really haven't been working, that the whole stock market is supported by central banks. And we're made to think that as long as the stock market's doing well, then the economy's doing well. But the stock market is obviously not the economy, and the economy's not doing that well. And the workers haven't gotten a raise at all on balance. So they're doing poorly relative to the rest of the market. And the fact that they haven't gotten raises shows that we're not at full employment like it's alleged. Supposedly, once you hit full employment, then the workers will demand more money, and that's why they don't allow it to go to full employment. They only let it go to, I think, 4.3% is supposed to be the unemployment. It's supposed to be the cutoff. So they're making it look like their moves have been successful just by propping up the stock market, which doesn't really show that at all.
So this roaring bull market that is now historically sized keeps getting bigger and bigger. You're suggesting is substantially propped up by these enormous investments by central banks. Does that mean that the economy itself then is a much different animal than people are led to believe?
Yes. I mean, the point of my article, or buying up the planet, was that they may not be now, but they have the power to buy up anything they want, because they create all the money they want. And this is a quite dangerous situation when you consider that many of these central banks are private or privately controlled. They all, not counting Iran and the ones that we're trying to wipe out, like Libya. Anyway, for the most part, they have declared their independence from government, so they're not there to serve the government or the people. They're there to serve the banks. That's their goal. And we know from Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, in 1966, that their goal, when they formed the Bank for International Settlements, their goal was to control markets, to control economies while making it look like the governments controlled them. So they're well on their way to that. And I cited Richard Werner, who thinks they purposely create booms and busts, because then when everything busts, of course, the people who still have money can go in and buy everything up. So it just consolidates the wealthy over the poor.
If you don't mind, I'd like to read that clip of yours from Professor Quigley, who was, I think, one of Bill Clinton's mentors, right?
Yeah, he was a professor of history at Georgetown University.
At Georgetown, because it is a stunning admission and a descriptor of things that we talk about later on in the program today about how the banks operate and what their big plans are. This paragraph that you quoted goes like this: from Tragedy and Hope in 1966, Professor Quigley said, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. end quote. And that, of course, is, as you acknowledge, that something that's already been largely achieved. But it's a stunning admission, and especially when you see that this was delivered 50 years ago. So now we're on the path where this global system has been self-realized and has complete facility with determining markets and economies, and has taken over the democratic role, to the extent that it was ever in place, of governments and public policy.
Right. And speaking of recent news, Ben Bernanke and Timothy Geithner and Henry Paulson, who were instrumental in the rescue operation or alleged rescue operation in 2008-2009, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on September 7th, commemorating the fact that it's 10 years since the collapse in 2008, saying that the Fed needs more tools. Well, they've already got tools they never had before. Quantitative easing, for one. Oh, it's just shocking that they could do that. And one tool they want is the ability to buy up individual stocks. I think they're talking about buying up individual banks or buying the stock of individual banks that might go south. So they're talking about expanding their powers, and they already have enormous powers. And also, we know that when they hint about something that they want to be able to do, they're probably already doing it. They're probably already doing it behind the scenes.
Yeah. Here, one of the things you've said, Ellen, is that in a new collapse, or in the next collapse, we would want to see the Fed nationalized rather than bailed out in the fashion that they did before.
Yeah, well, the Fed didn't get bailed out, but we'd want to nationalize it, and we could use those tools, but we want to make sure they're used for the benefit of the people. I mean, if you did nationalize it, turn it into a true public utility, central banks could be generating money for all sorts of useful things, like infrastructure is the first thing that comes to mind, and quantitative easing for the people in general. And there are several people, well, the Democracy Collaborative had a couple of papers out about how the Fed could buy up the oil industry, nationalize the oil industry. That would be one way to do it. Typically, you think of nationalizing an industry, like Venezuela nationalized their oil industry, and this, of course, makes prior owners quite upset when you take their property. But you wouldn't have to take it. You could buy it on the stock market without even, you don't have to ask their permission or do legislation. You just step in and buy the stock. So you could buy up big banks that failed. And the objection to that before, to nationalizing the banks, was that then the people would be stuck with their liabilities, all these bad debts that brought them down. But if you got the central bank doing it, the central bank can pay off those bad debts in the same way by generating money. And Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Treasury Secretary, says we should nationalize the media and the armaments industry. I mean, I don't know if he was thinking of actually buying their stock. That would be a bit pricey. But then you would say, well, surely that's going to be inflationary if you print all that much money. But not necessarily. And there's another man I'd like to interview who just came out with a book, Daryl Hermanutz, who's Canadian. And he actually comes out of the social credit school of thought. But he shows that all money is created as a debt. We now know that. It's created by banks, except for the 5% or so that's paper money and coins. All digital money is created by banks as a loan. So all money in existence, or that 95%, is all owed back to somebody. And that's why we have massive debts. That's why there are debts everywhere, because as the money supply grows, the debts have to grow. And in fact, they grow faster than the money supply because of interest, which means the debt is bigger than the money supply. And so his solution is we need to put more money out there. But he shows that only 20% of all this massive digitally created money actually is in the circulating consumer producer economy. 60% of it is with savers who have held the money back, and they're not spending it. They're not out there buying goods and services. And another 20% is in the stock market and what he calls a shadow banking system. So it's also out of the market. So you have like several economies going on at once, and the money doesn't trickle down from one to another. So if you bought, let's say you bought up the, armaments industry is pretty big. But Catherine Austin Fitch showed that they have $21 trillion in undocumented adjustments. In other words, that's money that they owe back to the government that they haven't accounted for. So let's say you bought them out and required them to pay off their debts. Every time you pay off a debt, you have liquidated money. So you've just added some money in, but you've already also taken money out. 80% of, I'm going to write an article on this, maybe I shouldn't go into it too much, but 80% of Americans are in debt. So what if you did a universal basic income at $1,000 a month? That's Daryl's proposed solution, that you need to get more money out there because there is not enough money in the circulating economy ever to close the gap between the price of things and the amount of money that workers have available to buy the stuff that they produce. So you need to fill that gap. So he says if everybody gets $1,000 a month, well, what if you said that everybody who is in debt needs to use it to pay down their debts, which would help them, you know, pay off that car that you've got a car loan on or whatever. Right. So it would definitely be good for them. They don't have to pay interest on the thing. But it would also liquidate that amount of money in the system. So anyway, there are all different ways you can look at these numbers. My guess is you could actually buy that stuff out without creating
inflationary. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating idea from the Democracy Collaborative, taking climate action to the next level, that you quote the idea of buying out the oil companies as a way of saying, okay, guys, you've had your fun, you've made your profits, here are your winnings. Now, we'll take over the fossil fuel industry, and we will slowly and orderly take it down and reverse our energy policy and our energy infrastructure towards something that is sustainable. Fascinating idea. Basically, a call for a new monetary paradigms, I think, is where we're at in this stage of things. And Ellen, I was interested to hear that this guy Daryl you're talking about is a social credit fan from Canada. This is also what our topic discussion is, the basis of the Alberta Treasury branches that we're talking with Mark Anielski about in just a few minutes. So thanks for bringing us even a more current example of how that can work.
Yeah, I'll just say, when I first started writing about this, a woman wrote to me from England who was a social creditor, and she said, you don't know how lucky you are. She said, we've been beating this horse for 100 years, and we haven't gotten out there. So maybe it's finally a chance for the social creditors to have their day and make their points.
Well, this is all an idea whose time has come. So we'll see what happens next. Thanks, Ellen. Talk to you in a bit.
Thank you.
As we just discussed with Ellen, the reach of the global financial cartel in the form of its central banks has a variety of abilities to dramatically inflate or depress world trading markets, simply because they control so much capital. This, of course, has huge impact and implications for the rest of us, as we hear now from Bob Bowes, who gives us a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control.
In this segment, Step 3, Transposing the Money Cartel's Point of View, from our new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, we provide a high-level overview of the global power structure, how it got that way, its objectives, and some examples of how it operates. Understanding this structure is the basic requirement for having any context regarding global events. How did we get here? The high-level view of the progression of events over the last 500 years that lead from money being converted to capital via usury to the present nearly monolithic control by a few families over the world's economic and political structures runs like this. Point. In the 15th and 16th century, European goldsmiths provided letters of credit for merchants who leveraged them to accelerate international trade and capital accumulation, as well as provide impetus to the Industrial Revolution. These letters of credit are backed by gold, which the goldsmiths do not own, only secure for their clients. Point. The interest income of goldsmiths quickly placed them among the wealthiest persons in Europe, which they leveraged into banking licenses granted by the crowns of various kingdoms and principalities. Point. These bankers then began implementing what remains one of their tried-and-true methods of bankrupting sovereign nation states through debt slavery, staging false flag events to draw countries into war. Point. By the second half of the 18th century, banking families exerted control over various governments, including the fledgling United States of America, via the First Bank of the United States. Point. The battle between the private banks and the people of the United States continued until 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed while most of Congress was on recess. This created a privately owned central bank that issued private banknotes, so-called Federal Reserve Notes, which ostensibly serve as legal tender for the world's largest economy. Point. In short order, World War I followed, with the Depression a decade after that, driving many nations, including the U.S., into an unsustainable progression of debt. Point. In 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement set the stage for Federal Reserve Notes becoming the world reserve currency in the early 50s. Point. Thus, the private banks that owned the Federal Reserve System controlled a printing press by which they could buy any assets on the planet without ever being subject to an audit. Point. By 1991, David Rockefeller, speaking for the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel, was able to declare that the takeover was complete and that, quote, the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national self-determination practiced in past centuries, end quote. Point. As a result of this consolidation, by 2011, a peer-reviewed study by three complex systems analysts from the Swiss Federal Institute in Zurich showed that the core of the key 43,060 transnational corporations on the planet are controlled by 147 public holding companies, which, in turn, are likely controlled by less than 20 privately held holding companies, were that information available. Point. That study, coupled with a study by the United States House of Representatives in 1976, which determined that the original handful of families that controlled the Federal Reserve when it began in 1913 still controlled it, lays bare the planetary power structure. Essentially, it reveals that the cartel controls a majority of the key corporations and governments on the planet, including the military and intelligence apparatuses, the mass and social media, the political parties, polling organizations and electronic voting and counting machines, the legal, medical, agricultural, and educational systems, and more. So what is the strategy of the cartel in operating these powerful levers? As we've discussed in various articles, the key objectives of the 1/100,000th of 1% are encapsulated in the following mnemonic: power, profit, propaganda, population reduction. Let's take a look at these objectives one at a time. Power. With unlimited funding from the Fed, the Pentagon spends more money on armaments and surveillance than the combined military budgets of China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, India, France, and the United Kingdom, and Japan. U.S. troops are present in over 150 countries. Profit. The cartel's control over the global economy includes profiteering in all key industries, including war, healthcare, and education, and the rigging of all financial markets. Propaganda. The cartel controls military and civilian intelligence operations embedded throughout the corporate mass and social media, which are controlled by less than a half dozen companies, and the educational system, which is controlled by federal and state proxies, as well as grant funding and budgeting. Population reduction. As we note in an article on our blog entitled Eugenics and Capitalism, the cartel aims to reduce the world population to below 1 billion persons. This is being accomplished through war and the poisoning of our air, water, food, and medicines. It's difficult to determine the actual population numbers at this time because the key aggregators are the CIA and the UN, two operations controlled by the cartel. Yet, despite these objectives, and while the cartel's power is certainly unprecedented in human history, it is not without its weaknesses and antidotes, as we will begin to detail in our next chapter, Step 4, Making Money a Public Utility Through Sustainable Economics. From Behind the Curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Bob Bowes' new book, 7 Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, is available from Amazon. And now we go to our featured guest this week to talk about the largest public bank in North America. And it's not the Bank of North Dakota.
Mark Anielski is an economic strategist from Alberta, specializing in the economics of well-being, which is a very cool topic. He's the president of Anielski Management, Inc., and the co-founder of the Center for Integral Finance and Economics, founded in London, I guess, and the author of 2 books, one of which was titled The Economics of Happiness, Building Genuine Wealth, again, a great title. And just recently, in May, he published a book called An Economy of Well-Being, which we'll also be talking about. So, Mark, it's great to be talking to you.
Great talking to you, Ellen. I'm Walt.
So we're particularly interested in your report on Alberta, which just came out along with a co-author for Parkland Institute. There's a report on the Alberta Treasury branches, which are not actually a bank, but they basically do banking services, and it's been around since 1938, did some brilliant things up until the 1970s when it got somewhat corrupted after that. But anyway, today it's a $50 billion deposit-taking financial institution with $18 billion in investments and nearly 750,000 customers. So it's like all over the province of Alberta. And it's 7 times the size of the Bank of North Dakota and the largest public bank in the North American continent. So that makes it very interesting to us how they've done and where they failed and what could be done with them. So, Mark, take it away with some discussion of the ATB.
Sure. Thanks, Ellen. So Bob Aska is my co-author on this study. Basically, it's a celebration of the 80th anniversary of the founding of ATB, which was September 29th, 1938. And during the Great Depression, Alberta was effectively bankrupt, and our premier, Bill Eberhardt, known as Bible Bill because he was actually a preacher, came across some ideas. C.H. Douglas in England, who was basically the leader of the Social Credit Party there, and Alberta kind of pioneered the development of, first of all, its own money. We actually created our own credit, which quickly became offside with Toronto, with the bankers in the East, and they forbid Alberta to create their own money. But we did create what was called the Alberta Treasury Branch, or ATB, known today ATB Financial. It's an arm of the Alberta Treasury or Finance Ministry, accountable to the Treasury Board, which is the government. So while we can't call ATB a bank, according to at least federal legislation, effectively ATB has been operating as a bank with full financial services for 80 years. And most people, including Albertans, don't appreciate what it means to have your own bank when every citizen effectively by birth and by living here are members of this bank. You're not a member if you live in Ontario or BC, but you certainly are a full member here in Alberta. Because this ATB operates under legislation to serve the financial needs of Albertans, it does not pay taxes, nor does it have to generate a profit. Therefore, it gives ATB a natural, let's call it a natural advantage vis-a-vis the commercial banks.
One of the things that fascinated me about it is that back in the 30s, during the Depression, when Canada's economy and the U.S. economy was in the tank, they came forward with this idea, like the people in North Dakota, and it was founded on agricultural funding purposes, right? It was basically a farmer's finance bank. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the social credit? It was established by social credit. What does that mean? There's a whole school around that.
I don't pretend to know all the theories of C.H. Douglas, but he was an engineer. He was a military guy in Britain, and he wrote this thing called the A plus B theorem of credit, and he understood the money system and how money was created and how it could be created, and that this notion of credit tied to kind of the social capital, and like North Dakota, Alberta is very agricultural based, could be a model for creating credit relative, say, to the land and the assets of the province. And so I would say that Alberta executed Douglas's ideas as effectively, I think, as Douglas himself would like to see. It was a preacher named Bill Eberhard, who became our premier, who had read Douglas's work and was so enamored with it, he said, well, why don't we try it here, and brought Douglas over here, and Douglas came here and thought Alberta was came in the spring when the spring melt and the muddy fields, and he thought it was a hellhole, and he went back to England.
I actually wrote a bit about it in the Public Bank Solution, a half a chapter. So that originally they attempted to, the social credit thing is that the government should issue a national dividend to fill in for the gap that's always there between the money that is paid out to workers and the price of the product. And that's because the producers have costs beyond the workers, and that money gets lost somewhere. It doesn't come back. It's not available for purchasing products. I have a little problem with the A plus B theorem, but in general, I mean, that seems almost obvious that if all your money is created as a loan and you take back more in principal and interest than you pay out in the original loan, there's never going to be enough money in the money supply. There's always going to be a shortage. And also because some people don't spend their money, they tuck it under the mattress or whatever, they save it in some way, or it goes abroad, or, you know, goes in offshore tax havens, or just winds up in the speculative economy and never makes it back into the consumer economy where it's available to purchase products. And therefore, we have an insufficient consumer market, that there's not enough demand, and therefore producers don't produce up to capacity. They could produce more, but you've got to get more money out there first. So the idea was that the government should pay a national dividend. And apparently Alberta did that. They did two national dividends. And then the federal government said, no, you can't do that. That's, you know, only the federal government had the power to print money, and that the Alberta government couldn't do it. So they quit. But they continued to do it in a rather sneaky way by setting up these treasury branches. And the government would pay their workers largely in these credits that you could only use in the treasury branches, but people liked them because you got a 3% discount on goods, and, you know, there were various advantages to using these. I guess they were called
euphemistically was called funny money. You know, of course, they maligned this idea of a dividend and call it funny money. And
right, but these are called transfer vouchers. So you would just transfer the money from one account to another without actually paying the money out. And that's how they managed to keep all these deposits. They have an extensive deposit network. So they would manage to keep all these deposits in the bank, and therefore they could lend them out because people didn't really pull their deposits out. What they did was transfer these transfer vouchers among each other. So that was very clever. It worked very well. In fact, I'd be curious how they did pull that off, where they made massive loans, but they weren't a bank. I mean, how did they get away with that when, what if the depositors come for their money and they say, wait, I didn't, you weren't authorized to use my deposits. But apparently they do, like all banks do, just create it on their books and use these transfer vouchers for most payments.
Yeah, although Eberhard may have not been successful at these transfer vouchers, tokens, whatever you want to call them. In fact, what Alberta did get is a full-fledged, full financial service bank, because ATB is a full depository bank, creates loans just like the other commercial banks out of thin air, but as with other banks, not actually backed by anything real except for ability to service a loan. So in that sense, Alberta has exactly what we complain about the private banks having, is this power to create money through fiat. And so that puts us in an extraordinarily powerful position. And if, because ATB doesn't have to generate a profit, the only thing it has to do is recover its operating costs. And then the question is, well, what are the operating costs of ATB? Well, we found, at least last year, the operating costs of the total system of ATB relative to loans is 2.5% compared to North Dakota's, which was 0.69% last year. And so it begs the question, what is the real cost of creating credit in today's weather? And what's the potential lower cost in a fintech future where you don't have 5,000 employees or physical branches to heat and service? So these are the fundamental questions I'm encouraging Albertans to talk about.
I would think the difference might be that, like you said, they've got all these branches servicing all these individual depositors, whereas the Bank of North Dakota basically doesn't take individual deposits. 98% of their deposits are from the state itself, so that's very easy.
So as an Albertan, I have, you know, we had our home mortgage from ATB. I've had a business account with ATB. We have our investment portfolios, our credit cards, our MasterCard. So it's a full-service financial institution.
How do you get away with that? How do the private banks allow that to continue?
I'm curious how they manage to make big loans, like mortgage loans. If you think about It's a Wonderful Life, the movie, where before we had deposit insurance, a bank that just took in the deposits of the neighbors and then lent them out to the other neighbors could get into serious trouble. So the ATB, I assume, if it's not officially a bank, it doesn't have deposit insurance from the federal government, and it doesn't have a pot of, you know, it can't borrow, I assume, from the central bank, that type of thing. So how do they make sure that they, is it just they tap up the province's funds if they run short?
Absolutely. It's 100% backed by the province, by the Treasury Board, which is, you know, the government. And so this is a fundamental question, again, is if in a perfectly constructed true social credit system, and I sit on the Provincial Audit Committee, where it's six private members that review the books of the province and the Auditor General's report, and I keep saying, we do not have a proper balance sheet of the assets of the province. What do you mean? It's like, well, the oil in the ground isn't on Alberta Inc.'s balance sheet, and it should be. So a properly constructed financial institution called ATB and a $100 billion investment corporation should be guided by the balance sheet, the revealed and verified assets of the province, particularly natural resources, and therefore loans then can be secured against those assets and never at risk because the province owns the natural resources under the Constitution of Canada. So what's backstopping every loan of ATB is basically the assets of the province of Alberta.
Mm-hmm. But if they actually were on the verge of bankruptcy, you would have to sell those assets, right? I mean, it's not the same. That's why they keep capital very liquid, so that you have money that's instantly there, no?
But this is a great lie, Ellen. We say you're putting your assets at risk because you have to, at risk to who? We own the bank. They're our assets. We're leveraging, we're lending, we're using the same principle of banking, lending against the underlying asset value and the future value of the oil, of the agricultural land, even water, if you like. And as an accountant, I know that the game here is, how do I verify that an asset, say call land, actually has future value? How do I know it has future value? And whatever future use the land is going to be used for, whether it's a home, a condo, a farm, a pipeline, etc. And so this is the game. The game is the asset accounting, the valuation against which credit now is created.
Well, I'm just wondering, though, what about in, say, a 2008 situation? What happened was that the repo market collapsed, which was where the banks got their liquidity, so their credit froze up, and so they had to get bailed out by the federal government. But they were bailed out because they were regular federally insured banks, you know, and the depositors got their money because of FDIC insurance. But if you don't have FDIC insurance, and if the state, let's say all the depositors freaked and pulled their money out for some reason, and it wasn't there to pay the loans, then is there some big pool of money that the province has that could be tapped up, or would you have to then sell the assets that were supposedly the capital of the bank?
Well, I think you know the answer. Half of ATB's loan portfolio, I think it's half, are mortgages. And then the next piece would be business loans, agricultural loans, student loans. And so the question is, under what conditions would 750,000 Albertans suddenly go bankrupt and lose their homes? Under what economic catastrophe could that happen? And then what would happen with the homes now as sterile assets? Nothing. We would still occupy them. We'd still live in them. We wouldn't abandon the province. And the oil
yeah,
modality.
Yeah, that's true. I was thinking if the depositors all pulled their money out, there wouldn't be liquidity, but I guess then they just quit lending. The reason that's interesting to me is
we're the depositors. We are the depositors. We own the assets. We live here. We own the bank.
No, but what if for some reason they discovered it was a really corrupt bank and that all the money was disappearing for some reason, and so they all rushed and pulled their deposits out? There wouldn't be any, the liquidity would be gone.
Of course, but then this relates to the other point Bob and I are making our paper, because Bob's fussy about the governance structure. He goes, you know, in the 1990s, ATB was playing a bit fast loose, giving big business loans to, you know, wealthy business guys making big bets, mm-hmm. right? On meatpacking plants or whatever it was, and ATB made some pretty stupid loans. And what they're saying is since then we've strengthened the governance process, the protocols for decision-making by the board, because ATB is accountable to the Treasury Board, which is a finance minister and caucus premier. Mm-hmm. What you need to make sure is that every loan made is backed by good investment options, businesses that have good business plans, households that are hopefully resilient in employment, et cetera, in a province which is highly vulnerable to oil shocks going forward, right? We may be sitting on the oil sands, which might become a stranded asset. So that's a big, huge risk to us. We can't get our oil to the tidewaters. We can't even build our own pipeline. So this is the existential kind of angst going on right now in the province, is what is mm-hmm. our future if we can't get our oil out? But it would simply mean that, is Alberta flirting with potential bankruptcy again? And I would say, no, I don't think so, because we're way more resilient. We have way more diversification of assets than we did back in the 30s. And yes, you know, 40% of our GDP is coming from oil, but, you know, it's not going to evaporate overnight.
Well, one of the things, the big questions here in the U.S. About public banking is governance, and how do you keep the sticky influences of special interests away mm-hmm. from the lending process. It's notable, I think, that the ATB in its 80 years has only been embroiled in, as you say, two scandals, only two in 80 years. And, of course, the Bank of North Dakota also has a very clean record of keeping political interests and special interests
yeah.
separate. How is that regulatory or managerial governance provided? What does it look like for ATB?
Right now it has an independent board, ATB, right, which represents, has an ex officio position, almost like the U.S. Fed in a way. It's like, well, the president has an ex officio position on the Federal Reserve Board. The board and the CEO of ATB is ultimately accountable to the finance minister. So whether the finance minister sits on the board meetings or not, there's an independent board of Albertans, and that board is responsible for ensuring ATB is resilient. So it has a responsibility, really, to Albertans and to the Treasury Board itself. But the temptation, of course, is strong. Actually, I have to say this jokingly, if the current finance minister, Joe Cici, actually understood that he has the golden goose, he can lay as many golden eggs as he can now and get this province back on its feet, what would he tell the golden goose to produce right now? What
right.
kind of loans or credit? That's a big temptation to go, well, I want solar panels in everyone's house. Okay, yeah, we could do that in the next 10 years, but would that be a responsible thing to do? I don't know. But I'm just saying power.
How much sun do you have?
is right under his thumb right now.
Mm-hmm.
He could direct Treasury Board to do exactly what we're Treasury Board and the ATB to do exactly what I'm talking about. But under what conditions would the loan portfolio be managed so it makes sure the province is actually resilient?
So in your governing structure, you have an advisory board of various types of talents and professions represented, I
yeah.
presume.
So every 3 years, a new board position opens up on ATB because their terms are 3 years.
Uh-huh.
So now I apply as a citizen. Anyone can apply.
And then
I get interviewed, I get vetted, I get secured, all that stuff, right? And then I could become a new member of the board, which is approved by the Premier herself. The Premier
uh-huh.
actually approves my potential position on the board.
So
but
that's interesting. It's actually government-owned, and the government actually has the last word on what the credit goes for. Is that right? I mean, that's what we've been saying central banks should do, so it's really like a central bank.
We lost the game as the Federal Reserve of the U.S. we basically lost it to Canada because the Bank of Canada abrogated its power to the private bank. And here in Alberta, we have what everyone lost, and we don't even know what we've got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. What's interesting to me is that in California, there's this whole push for the one issue was the cannabis bank problem, which, of course, goes against the federal government's regulations. So we wouldn't have FDIC insurance, and we might not even be able to get a chartered bank. And then you have this whole network of local cities that are working to set up publicly owned banks, and they, too, have a challenge getting a state charter. But if we could set up a system rather like the ATB system where it's a government network and backed by the California also has massive resources and you wouldn't necessarily need to be a chartered bank. You could just take in people's deposits and lend them out again, I guess. I'm still a little stumped what happens, how you protect all that.
I keep saying, Ellen, it's we the people who protect. If we go bankrupt personally, what happens? You know what happens. You go bankrupt, what happens? The bank seizes your assets and then has to sell. Oh, sorry, we have to sell that house that you sat in, but we actually just created this mortgage out of thin air in the first place. It's not really backed by anything but except your ability to work and pay the interest. So ATB is already playing that role. So we the people own this bank. We the people either flourish or don't flourish. And so it is truly the we the people system. I can't explain it more simply because in our heads we're playing the same old storyline, which is, well, in the conventional commercial banking world, if there's a run in the bank closes because there's not enough money on deposit to pay, right, the depositors, blah, blah, blah. You and I know that there's actually no assets supporting that loan as such, no except our ability to pay from our labor. And what I'm saying is if you structure a proper public bank founded on the verified assets of the jurisdiction, the city, Ben Franklin was writing about this, right, for Philadelphia, then you have, I think, a far more robust, properly constituted banking system that's backed by assets.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and this bank does not lend to itself or to the municipality, to the government, for infrastructure, from what you've said. Why is that?
So what bothers me about, because Alberta's been deficit financing, so our annual operating budget for the government is $50 billion. So the last 2 years, we've gone into debt, sell bonds, $10 billion worth of debt every year. So we're probably going to go to about $700 billion of debt. And you do the math, right? So what's the interest? So the question I ask is, who are we selling our debts to? Who's bought our $10 billion? And he said, the markets. I said, no, the markets. Oh, there's order papers. Well, actually, technically, we sell it to bond traders, and they sell it to, then they take it to the market. So you're saying that the Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan, or maybe even the state of Illinois, actually could buy Alberta's debt. Yep. And you don't really know who owns it anymore. No, because it goes into a million different pieces. So, oh, wait a minute, you wrote the paper, you created the bonds, we have our own investment company called Alberta Investment Management Corp, which is kind of sister to ATB, it's a $105 billion investment fund.
Wow.
How much Alberta bonds can AIMCo hold legally? And he looks at me and goes, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? How much Ontario debt bonds does AIMCo hold? Well, we can tell you that. But you can't tell me what's the legal limit for how much debt Alberta can hold when we have our own bank. And you are the guy issuing the debt paper. And you can't tell me who holds their debt. It's just outrageous. And I don't get a straight answer, which is interesting. And so then I said, well, you know, the Bank of North Dakota can issue infrastructure loan to the state and therefore recycle the interest payments. The interest payment is just a wash. Why can't we do that? We have more than North Dakota has here.
You can't get an answer?
I don't get a straight answer. They're either trying to avoid, they know the answer, or they actually never thought about it. They're not creative enough to think that, wait a minute, mm-hmm. ATB, and I'm not saying ATB plays a role here. This is the Treasury, the Ministry of Finance is issuing the paper called the bond to finance our way into balanced budget. Actually, no, we're deficit financing. And we're chalking up, we're closing in on $70 to $80 billion now of debt. which we were debt-free like 3-4 years ago. Alberta had no debt at all.
Wow, and that was all due to the collapse of the oil? You know, yep. North Dakota also suffered from oil collapse, and what they did was they hit up the Bank of North Dakota for an extra dividend, or for a dividend.
There you go.
I guess they hadn't collected dividends for a number of years because they'd been using their profits to add to the capital base of the bank because there was so much demand for the loans. That's another use of having your own bank, is that it's like a rainy day fund.
Yes. So what I've said to the finance minister here is that I think we have something to learn from North Dakota because they're creating infrastructure loans through the bank. Why can't we do that? And he goes, oh, that's interesting. And then radio silence.
The history of the Bank of North Dakota also suggested a period of not very dynamic strategizing. They weren't doing very much investing for a long time. Alan could certainly speak a lot more to that, but it's a relatively recent phenomenon that they've really been turning profits and making productive loans. Is that not right, Alan?
Yeah, that's true. I think in the last 20 years or so.
Right.
Before that, they were just very conservative in how they invested, like largely government securities.
I thought that the term conservative was interesting in the Alberta Treasury branch's history because it was the progressive conservatives that funded the bank. We don't have that kind of a phrase or political entity in the U.S.
Actually, to be clear, the Social Credit Party ruled this province for 40 years. And then in 1971, a young Peter Lougheed, former football player and lawyer, founded the Progressive Conservative Party and took over from the Social Credit. And then ran the province for 44 years until Rachel Notley, my backdoor neighbor here, the new Democratic Party, has been now party in power for 4 years.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of progressive thinking and new applications for the bank, you had talked about the fintech as one possible generational or technological application for the bank. What kind of a role do you see there?
Right now, ATB has a very significant artificial intelligence unit and have been playing with blockchain technology and not cryptocurrency yet, but they're already experimenting with advanced blockchain smart contracts. If you know what a smart contract is, it basically says instead of waiting for Swift code, you know, 3-4 day transactions moving money, I can wire money to Germany in under 30 seconds. The discussion I'm having with some people in the blockchain space is what if ATB starts to really get advanced by creating an ecosystem of smart contracts between members? And some of the senior guys at ATB are already saying, like, in 5 years, we're at 5,000 employees. We're lucky if we'll have 1,000 employees. Because why do you need all these branches in a fintech future where blockchain transactions are highly coded and verified? There'll be less need for due diligence protocols, and we'll be able to move money. And the fact that ATB is invested in a very significant AI future is encouraging.
For maybe some of the ways that we can talk about public banking in the U.S., because we are in this formative stage of how are we going to govern, what are these banks going to do, I think we would be hard-pressed to imagine that public banks in the U.S. would get away with what the ATB in Alberta is doing in competing so directly for the markets of personal lending. And yet, we're seeing that about 25% of our populace here is underbanked or unbanked. So
right.
Those whole services are waiting to be addressed. And
I'll tell you a story. So ATB Premier Rachel Notley got set payday loans or money market. They prey on poor people. And she said, this is outrageous, it's injustice. And so they told ATB to figure out a way of eliminating these payday loans, or at least an alternative. So they set up basically very personalized financial services to street people, poor people in the inner city here at Edmonton. And they've been very successful. So these are providing financial literacy services. Of course, ATB can do it because they're making lots of money. Like I could tell you, 2.5% operating cost to the loan is a very luxurious operating system. So they said, yeah, we'll take it on. And so they've been experimenting with a local, bank in the inner city, financial services to street people who don't have the financial literacy, who only maybe need $100 or so. That's happening right now.
Wow. Do you know what interest rate they make these payday loans? I mean, the equivalent of?
I don't know, are they losing
money on this deal? Or they?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they're losing money, but because I've
they can afford
also
it.
Learned
okay.
that, of course, it's going to be a higher ratio with the labor required to just operate the system. But the other point I want to make on this show is what I've shown the finance minister is that the Habitat for Humanity model, which offers zero interest home equity mortgages to low-income households, so anyone in a $40,000 a year household income is kind of a typical Habitat for Humanity client. They can issue a zero interest home equity mortgage. The average duplex here would be $350,000. The bank wouldn't even give them a mortgage because they make too little. So they're already forced into subsidized, maybe subsidized affordable housing, rental housing. And so what I've shown is Habitat model saved that typical household, if they actually had a mortgage, about $9,000 to $10,000 in avoided interest a year. $9,000 to $10,000 is a lot when you're only making $40,000. So I said to the treasurer, what you could do is have ATB fashion the same mortgage instrument as Habitat is doing, just for covering your operating costs to create that mortgage and manage it, and actually help eliminate poverty. Because the average household in Habitat, in 5 years, they've typically graduated out of that low-income situation. So now they're making $50,000, and they actually don't want to be in a Habitat home anymore. And they get 100% of everything they paid towards that mortgage, 100% of principal back when they leave that home. So imagine you've graduated 5 years later, you walk out with $50,000 in your jeans to go now buy your home because you're actually economically better off as well. And I said,
wow,
that's
how
something
can they afford
could
to do that, though, if it's no-interest loans?
They have this fabulous model where cities give, often they give the land, or a developer will give land to them for nothing. Then they have, of course, voluntary labor. They get lots of voluntary supplies from Home Depot or whatever. So they can construct a home. The cash needed just to construct the home is probably $100,000 a door. So a lot of it's based on free giving of time and materials, but the point is you could do it, and you could certainly do it when you have your own bank to actually support that kind of issue.
As you know, I'm fascinated with that model, and I think it's something that we need to be including as we talk about affordable housing solutions in the U.S. and what the public bank could do, because traditionally affordable housing as a bank investment is a very risky job or a risky place
to be
because they're dealing with private finance. But as you say, with the bank, if you own the bank, then you can own the assets of the house, and the house asset is constantly always in the care and the equity position for the city, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for sharing this insight about the Alberta Treasury branches. And our audience, we feed a lot of information to them about how banking is operating and how they work and what public banks could represent. Here we have a beautiful example, again in Canada, of a powerful bank that it, too, is in the process of discovering its potential. Moving through the fog of unconsciousness and of public and administrative unconsciousness about the power of having a bank. And so thank you very much for sharing that, and look forward to hearing some more news from what happens with your discussions with the Premier and other legislative developments there. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bert.
That's economist and author Mark Anielski. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.